Okay, so interview resumes. So Major General Fitch, could you please tell me about the professional lessons that you learned as a result of your deployment in the former Yugoslavia?
Okay, so there was a general mass of lessons. I mean, you learn stuff every day about how to move in a hostile country, about communicating with, you know, many different countries, many different languages. But perhaps the most important thing I learned was how to work in a multinational headquarters. While I was commandant of the School of Military Engineering, the first or second Canadian engineer colonel that was there, I guess Colonel Dave Harries, he came out of Yugoslavia. I mean, this was all very new to us, right? Because joining in 66, and, you know, there'd barely been a shot fired in anger until the early 90s. So one of the former chief engineers in the United Nations Protection Force, it was a Canadian colonel of engineers position, and I knew my turn was coming, because there just weren't that many of us. And this guy coming out came and paid me a visit. And one of the things was, he said, don't do what I tried to do. I tried to fix the UN. He said, it could drive you to an early grave. So I learned, I guess partly from his experiences and others, that there's a technique for working in highly political, multinational, dysfunctional headquarters, and most are to one degree or another. Technique, I saw a particular project that needed to be done. Might be a construction project, or it could have been mine clearance, whatever. First of all, I would never get any orders from higher in the UN structure. They just didn't do that. there's no leadership per se. They were just trying to keep the lid on things and everybody quiet and try and survive their 6 months or whatever and get the hell out of there. I mean, it's a totally negative kind of thing. But typically Canadians won't approach it that way. We're going there for a reason. We're going to do good. And, you know, maybe it's the Boy Scout mentality. I don't know what, but that's our military ethic. We're not going to waste our time there. So you can see things that need to be done. If you just went along the formal lines to get approval and resources, your 6 months would be over before you'd done anything. So what I learned was, you need to find a like-minded person in each of the different departments of the headquarters. Didn't matter what country that person was from, didn't matter what language they spoke, didn't even matter what rank they were. But somebody like-minded, you know, who like-minded in the sense that they shared your vision, they could see such and such a thing needed to be done. So this was networking, lateral networking, across these very complicated and highly dysfunctional headquarters. You can get stuff done. Because, you know, it goes into the transport section, and because you need some trucks or this or that or the other thing. And if you formally applied for trucks, as you say, you know, well, we don't have any this month, and next month we might get some, you know, whatever.
Come back in 3 months.
But your friend in that section knew how that section worked, could get the paperwork through, and you might have, you know, the head of the section, maybe could be quite a senior officer from, sadly, in many cases, underdeveloped countries, or sometimes very developed countries. Well, the guy was just a plug, where your friend could, you know, say, sign here, Colonel. Fine, you know, I signed, didn't even look at it. You know, so by this kind of friendly subterfuge, you could actually do stuff. And it became a little challenge. You know, when I first got there, I butted my head against it for a while. I said, no, it's not going to work. Let's try this. And it works like a charm. very effective. And so I used that in, you know, learned it in UNPF, really, applied it in NATO, because, I mean, NATO, even UN, the military part of the UN forces, the default way of doing things was the NATO standard way, because that was really the only kind of standard there is in the world. I mean, NATO standard became like a little joke in the UN, because, you know, how do you want to do that? Oh, NATO standard. Oh, okay, fine. You know, because most people know, and countries that weren't part of NATO would be aware of it or would learn it quickly and make sense. It's like a lingua franca. So it served me very well then when I went back to National Defense Headquarters in Ottawa, where the dysfunctional headquarters is really your whole of government and other departments that don't understand or don't want to understand the military. But find a like-minded person in that other department and you can do miracles. So it was a good lesson.
And a final question here. What about working with the various Serb, Croat, and Muslim military and paramilitary factions on the ground? You'd mentioned that the incident at the concentration camp in Kolbensko, was it? And I was just wondering if you could share any other experiences there, or sort of the general sense you had.
Let me introduce about tell a little story. My father was a veteran of World War II. He was a platoon commander of a rifle platoon in an infantry battalion that were spearhead troops all the way from Normandy through into Germany. In fact, it's the first Canadian battalion to raise their flag on German soil. Took terrible casualties. From the 6th of June to the 8th of August 1944, they had 800 casualties. It's dead and wounded. And from the 8th of August 1944 to VE Day, another 800. So it's like two complete battalions cycled through. He was the longest surviving subaltern on VE Day. So he's trying to understand what I'm doing, but his frame of reference is World War II. And communications were very bad. There was a so-called UN satellite telephone system that sometimes worked. So typically I'd get a phone call through to him about once a month. So he'd say, and he had a map. I'd left him with a map. I think I can show it to you here. Because coming out of the Directorate of Cartography or Geomatics, you know, they equipped me at least with that. So he had a map, and whenever I'd get a letter through or something, he'd put a little pin on where I was and stuff like that. So he'd say, get hold of him, Dad, and say, well, where's the front line today? I'd say, well, Dad, there is no front line, actually. Oh, he'd say, well, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys? And I'd say, well, Dad, actually, they're all a bunch of swine. So he asked me about the different factions there. I think, you know, the people in the former Yugoslavia, and remember that 80% of them, 1995-96 when I was there, 80% of them were in a different place than they were in 1990 before the Civil War started. So huge displacement and death. A lot of them, you know, ethnic cleansing, were pushed to other parts of the country. A lot of them left the country, and a lot, unfortunately, were killed. Didn't get any cultural training. I did some reading before going over there. A very good book by Misha Glenny, a British journalist of Yugoslav origins. That was very helpful in understanding the modern situation. And then I read a book. It was the only Yugoslav Nobel Prize for Literature. It's called Bridge Across the Drina. Drina is a major river in eastern Bosnia, southern Bosnia. Anton, I'm not going to come up with the name, but you know about the history of the Yugoslavs?
Little bit.
Yugo means south, so these are the southern Slavic tribes. At one time, Bosnia was almost all Serb. They were Eastern Orthodox. And in the 1500s, I'm going back a while here, they fought great battles that they feel they saved Europe from the Muslims, from the Turkish, the Ottoman Empire invasion, which at one point reached the gates of
Vienna, I think.
Vienna. Yeah, that's the story. And they couldn't understand why they were considered the bad guys by the West, because after all, they saved Europe. They're still reliving this battle of 500 years before. Same way the Irish refight their battles every year. The Croats, Roman Catholic, so there's that divide there, that East-West divide. I don't want to say generalize things about them. You know, stereotyping is just another form of racism. It's not very helpful. Well, and the Muslims, they're not much. Most of them are kind of nominal Muslims. They were really Christians, but they were followers of a monk named Bogomil. And Bogomil had a falling out with the Pope. Schism.
Mm-hmm.
And Bogomil was excommunicated, so he took his followers and went to the Turkish part of the country. By this point, you know, things had settled down. The Turks had this big chunk. And the Ottoman Empire was very tolerant, very welcoming. Say, come and live by our laws. We don't care whatever religion you espouse. You just do your thing. But they moved in there and getting no support from Christendom, I guess they eventually, over time, they assimilated and became Muslims. But these are smoking, drinking, pork-eating Muslims. Or they were. It's a different story now because the Islamists and particularly the Wahhabi, the Sunni Saudi Arabian influence exploited the opportunity of the Civil War to install their form of Islam. So in a small town that had a little mosque that people went to or didn't, I don't know, the mosque was destroyed. After we'd put the lid on it and reconstruction restarted, you come into this little town, there's this enormous thing going up, gift of your brothers from Saudi Arabia. And bringing their clerics in with their very fundamentalist form of Islam. So it's quite a change in the character. But in those days, I mean, we had trouble. Indigenous people there claimed, they weren't always right, interestingly enough, but they claimed to be able to look at somebody and know if they were a Serb or a Croat or a Muslim. But it's all the same gene pool. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same gene pool. So maybe it's like any society anywhere, where 95% of the population are law-abiding, and all they want to do is have a reasonable standard of living for their family and that their children should grow up healthy and get an education, a good job, and be happy, produce lots of grandchildren, right? Okay, I'm generalizing. Let's say there's a large part of the population of just about any country who would want to do that.
Normal, everyday people.
Okay, let's go with that. I would say there's also a small percentage of just about any country who are the criminal element. 2-3%, 2%, I don't know, or the idiot fringe, 1%, picking up. But then there's another small percentage who, if you're watching them, they'll be good. But if they think they can get away with something, they'll do it. So one of the ways the gangsters used to foment this civil war, and I mean this is Fitch's comic book version of what happened, and very simplified, But you know, Tito had an iron grip on the whole place and very much prized good relations between the ethnic groups. In fact, if anybody tried to foment anything between the ethnic groups, he was absolutely ruthless. If there was intermarriage between the ethnic groups, they would be rewarded with better pensions, better jobs, better vacation, you know, whatever. There were benefits for that. And if you tried to stir up trouble between the ethnic groups, the iron fist would come down. But Tito's gone. In fact, he'd been gone for 10 years. Such was his power. It took them fully 10 years to figure out the next tier down. Hey, he's not here anymore. He's not going to bash us. We can do what we want. So it's these gangsters, and how did you get to be a leader in a communist country? My observation is, to be the mayor of town, you had to be the biggest, meanest son of a bitch in town. You became the mayor. And if you were the biggest, meanest son of a bitch in the canton, you ran that canton. And so on until the present. President. So they had that gangster mentality with imposed rule of law. As soon as rule of law was taken away, and the gangsters needed the people to fight each other so that they could expand their areas, get more power, more money, whatever. So there'd be a little Croat town here, a little Bosnian Serb town here, or Muslim, I mean, pick, doesn't really matter. So the gangsters here would go to some of the yahoos in town, you know, young guys, and probably out of work, not very well educated, stereotyping, perhaps. And they'd say, here's $20 and a bottle of Slivovitz. I want you to go over to the next town and burn that barn. They go, what? You're giving us money and booze and we get to burn a barn? Hee-haw! You know, that kind of... So go down and burn the barn. They didn't know why the old grandmother was in there milking the cow and the barn burned down. So now her grandsons come looking for these guys. And then the whole thing spirals out of shape.
This vicious circle then.
Oh, vicious spiral. And then the 95% of the good people, they get drawn into it. They get called up to be in the army and, you know, it just goes to shit. So, I mean, I wouldn't get a nickel for any one of them over the others. I didn't have to make that kind of decision. I was wary of all of them. Either one of them would turn their parents in for, you know, there was evidence that the two big mortar shells that landed in the market in Sarajevo and did the terrible destruction there, the Croats, or the Muslims, I guess, blamed it on the Serbs.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence that the Muslims did it on their own people to get the Dayton Accord thing to happen and blah, blah, blah. They thought that was... I mean, that kind of ruthlessness. I had no time for any of them. Now, I met them all, had to deal with them with respect. After, once I-4 came in, a lot of our work was reforming the engineering sector of the country to get power going and water going. Cemeteries looked at, you know, a lot of people had been buried in temporary cemeteries, had, you know, because the municipal cemetery was in, say, the Serb sectors, so the Muslims couldn't bury anybody there, blah, blah, blah. So we'd be bringing them together, and often I'd be there chairing, say, the power committee. And these guys had come together, they hadn't seen each other in 4 years. And they knew they were safe in that room. Their security was guaranteed by NATO. And they knew they were supposed to work together. And, I mean, they wanted power in their home, so they were going to cooperate with that former enemy, you know, to repair the line and get it all working. And they'd meet and they'd say, oh, Joe, how you been? I haven't seen you in years. How's Fred? Oh, gee, too bad about Fred. Yeah, sorry to hear that. You know what? I mean, they'd all gone to school together, they'd worked together, then they were separated by the Civil War, and then we brought them back together again. But who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Not me to tell.
So this goes to the narrative form. Alright, so this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Major General Edward Fitch on 23 March 2011. Major General Fitch, could you please confirm that you've been provided with a copy of the interview release form prior to the interview?
Yes, that's true fact.
Alright. And at this point, I'd like to sign the form, sign and date the form, please, and I will do the same.
23rd. I'll take a copy. I've got a photocopier upstairs.
Right. Major General.
Yeah, okay, it's clear. Good.
Major General Fitch, we have both signed the interview release form, is that correct?
That's correct, Ron.
Right, I'd like to conclude this interview, General, by thanking you once again for your time and for your cooperation with the Military Oral History Project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.